Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Maria Luisa Mendonça, Director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, who examines the forces behind the impeachment of Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff. Panayoti Solkas, a co-founder of the Prison Ecology Project, who talks about how his group fuses the issues of environmental justice and prisoner rights. And citizen activist and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who discusses his upcoming Breaking Through Power conference in Washington, D.C., and some of the major issues in the 2016 election campaign. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In reaction to rising street violence, El Salvador's leftist president, Salvador Sanchez Cerén, arrested 16 people involved in negotiating a 2012 gang truce that lasted for 2 years and reduced the level of murders. El Salvador is now the most violent nation in Latin America, as two rival gangs, Mara Salvatrucha, or MS-13, and Calle 18, battle each other. But leading experts condemned the arrests as politically motivated and warned of potentially dire consequences. Adam Blackwell, a former representative of the Organization of American States who helped facilitate the negotiations, said, "This is a vindictive sacrificing of the lambs. Most of those people arrested are decent public servants. Truce or no truce, the authorities need a communications channel." The gang truce effectively cut the level of street violence, but then collapsed as promised reforms, such as reducing prison overcrowding, and programs for reintegrating prisoners into communities, never materialized. Former President Mauricio Funes was unable to persuade international lenders to provide aid for the reform programs, and private donors were prevented from giving funds after the U.S. declared MS-13 a terrorist group. The government has now embraced an iron fist strategy in mobilizing over 1,000 soldiers and unleashed a shoot-to-kill policy targeting suspected gang members, of which there are an estimated 70,000 in El Salvador. In the early days of the presidential campaign, the growing national opioid epidemic drew public attention to the growing number of addicts in white rural America. Many blamed the spike in heroin addiction on the widespread availability of legally prescribed opioid pain medications. 2 years ago, Vermont's Democratic Governor Peter Shumlin devoted his annual State of the State address to the new full-blown heroin crisis. Deaths in Vermont from opiate overdoses had doubled over the last decade, and the number of people seeking opiate treatment had risen 800% since 2000. At the February meeting of the National Governors Association's Health and Human Services Committee, Committee Chair Governor Charlie Baker, Republican of Massachusetts, said, "The United States represents 5% of the world's population and consumes 80% of the world's opioids. That's fundamentally flawed. When prescriptions are too hard to get or too expensive, addicts switch to heroin." However, the prospect of politicians reining in pharmaceutical sales is a stretch in the halls of Congress. Last year, Big Pharma spent more than $235 million to influence policy outcomes, the largest budget of any lobby group in Washington. New York City special education teacher Jia Li became so angry about Common Core teaching standards that she refused to give students a required test. She had earlier pulled her son out of testing without the support of her union, the United Federation of Teachers, or UFT. Li became well known for her defiant testimony on Common Core before the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. She complained that the constant emphasis on testing undermined critical thinking among students and forced parents to raise outside funds to pay for arts and music education. Now, Li is leading a reform campaign in New York City's teachers' union elections on May 26th by challenging pro-Common Core UFT president Michael Mulgrew on a slate backed by the Movement for Rank-and-File Educators, or MORE. MORE, an affiliate of the National Reform Network linked to the Chicago Teachers Union, which waged a successful strike in 2012, promotes a vision of social justice unionism in public education, where educators push against inequality in school districts and fight for more resources in communities of color. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After months of investigations, debate, and street protests by supporters and opponents of Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, Brazil's Senate voted to impeach the nation's first female head of state. Rousseff will now be put on trial over allegations that she violated fiscal regulations by using funds from state banks to cover budget shortfalls in order to continue funding popular anti-poverty programs. Now suspended from office, Rousseff's unpopular vice president, Michel Temer, has taken the reins of power for up to 6 months during the president's impeachment trial. Many of Rousseff's supporters, who benefited from her Workers' Party government's policies that lifted millions out of poverty, believe that the impeachment of the president is in fact a coup d'etat orchestrated by the president's political opponents and Brazil's wealthy elite. Unlike President Rousseff, many of those involved in the impeachment effort are under investigation themselves for crimes such as money laundering, forging documents, and misappropriating public funds. Among those accused is acting President Temer. Internationally known political dissident, linguist, and author Noam Chomsky said after the May 12th impeachment vote, quote, "We have the one leading politician who hasn't stolen to enrich herself, who's being impeached by a gang of thieves." Your reporter spoke with Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, and a professor at the University of Rio de Janeiro's International Relations Department. Here, Professor Mendonça examines the forces behind Rousseff's impeachment as she expresses concern for the repression that may now be unleashed.
Yes, I think the first thing that is important to understand is that the reason for the impeachment is a very common practice that several administrations have used. They basically borrow money from public banks to cover expenses with social programs in Brazil. So previous administrations have done this at the federal level, and currently, if we use the same criteria, at least 16 state governors would have to be impeached. So she's not being accused of any corruption charges. At the same time, that the Congress members from the opposition parties that are putting her on trial are the ones facing serious accusations of corruption. The Speaker of the lower house, who now had to step down, he was the one who orchestrated the impeachment process against her. And he's being charged of having millions of dollars in offshore accounts in Switzerland. And the public prosecutors in Switzerland have confirmed that information. So President Dilma actually gave more independence to the federal police to investigate cases of corruption. And I think that's one of the reasons why the conservative parties now are trying to stop the investigations by accusing her of a practice that cannot justify her impeachment.
What are the prospects that Dilma Rousseff will survive this trial and return to office as president?
Well, it doesn't look very good, which is very dangerous for democracy in Brazil and for the whole region. Because even before the vote, the Congress members in the Senate, in the lower house, have already expressed their opinions. And they didn't even mention the reason for the impeachment. In the lower house, it was a bizarre situation. One after the other, Congress members were saying that they approved the impeachment in the name of God, in the name of their families. One of them praised a former military commander known by performing torture against political prisoners during the military dictatorship. And now what we have, just 5 hours before taking power, the supposed new president is already making structural changes. He abolished just in 5 hours, the ministers of culture, of communication, of women, of racial equality, of agricultural development, and also the governmental bodies that used to control cases of corruption, that used to investigate those cases. So I think we're going to see a situation of repression against social movements that are protesting against what we see as a parliamentary coup.
Maria Luisa, I have heard that Michel Temer, Dilma Rousseff's vice president, who's now the acting president, may very well implement a neoliberal economic program even before any new national elections are scheduled. How much of a concern do you have that a lot of the programs that lifted millions of people in Brazil out of poverty over recent years that the Workers' Party was in government will now be reversed with this unelected president who's taking the reins of office in the midst of this crisis?
Exactly. He already announced several cuts in social programs, in health care, in education, and he appointed radical, evangelical, right-wing new ministers. For instance, the new minister of science and technology is a religious fundamentalist that doesn't believe in science. The new minister of health just said that, for instance, the problem of Zika virus is because the mosquito is not obedient. So we have this bizarre new cabinet of right-wing evangelicals that are cutting social programs already just in a few days. And what we are going to see probably is more economic instability, more social inequality, and all the gains that we had in the last decade. You know, President Dilma was elected and reelected. And at that time of her reelection, we had the situation of full employment in Brazil. Then right after she got reelected with 55 million votes, Brazil suffered a speculative attack from financial markets. And that was the reason why the economy was destabilized. And because there was no reason, it was different from here in the United States when you had a house bubble and then you had an economic crisis. In Brazil, suddenly we wake up and we have an economic crisis for no apparent reason. So there was a speculative attack against the economy, and at the same time, we had a huge campaign from corporate media, and all the TV networks started to call demonstrations against the government and tell people that the only way the economy was going to improve was that if there was a change in government. So it's important for people to understand that we don't have a parliamentary system in Brazil. It's a presidential system. So we cannot impeach a president just because at some point in her term, her popularity is low or some people don't like her. So we have to respect the result of the election. That's the main point we need to clarify.
That was Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, and a professor at the University of Rio de Janeiro's International Relations Department. Find more perspectives on the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A group of activists has brought together two seemingly disparate issues, criminal injustice and the environment, to create the Prison Ecology Project. The effort focuses on those who fill U.S. prisons, mostly poor and people of color, suffer as prisoners and also as victims of environmental injustice. One blatant example they brought to light was how prisoners in a New Orleans parish jail were treated as the levees broke after Hurricane Katrina. The prisoners were abandoned in their cells as the water rose around them before eventually being rescued. The Prison Ecology Project addresses issues such as damage of sewage and industrial waste from overpopulated and underregulated prisons into waterways, threats to listed species by the ongoing construction and operation of prisons in remote, environmentally sensitive rural areas, and environmental justice concerns regarding prisoners, staff, and surrounding communities. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Panayotis Solkas, who was a co-founder of the Prison Ecology Project in 2014. He recently helped develop the Campaign to Fight Toxic Prisons, which is holding a convergence in Washington, D.C. this June. Here, Solkas describes why he has chosen to do this work and what he hopes will come out of the upcoming convergence.
What happened in Katrina was pretty thoroughly documented, and it kind of opened a lot of people's eyes to the climate justice movement, and which I think, you know, in a lot of ways opened up the space to connect social and environmental issues in general. And the prison, the experience of people in that local prison there, I think the Orleans Parish Prison, you know, that experience, I think, really illustrated a piece of what we're talking about, where that people in prison are at a higher risk for, you know, various things, the impacts of climate change, of sea level rise, of temperature changes, what we've seen with the extreme heat cases that are happening across the South, where prisons, a lot of prisons, I'm here in Florida, a lot of prisons in Florida don't have air conditioning. People are just suffering through this hell of being in a giant metal box, basically. And there's been some good reports about that as well. So we've been taking some of the documentation of these various issues. A lot of them are coming out through the environmental justice angle or the prisoner rights angle, and then combining them together and saying, look, there's these overlaps between environmental justice and prisoners' rights, and it's a potential there for really powerful organizing.
Panayotis Solkas, what brought you into this work?
I've been involved with primarily environmental organizing for the last 17 or 18 years, and I was following prison issues as well as environmental issues, and generally sort of separate. There were just things I was interested in, and I got involved with activism through organizations like Earth First and Food Not Bombs and other grassroots, mostly anarchistic type of organizing. And I continue doing organizing through the Earth First Network primarily. And I was an editor on the Earth First Journal. And around the time that people started getting indicted and arrested in what we call the Green Scare, where there was this wave of FBI interest in environmental actions that had occurred over the last, you know, decade and a half or so. And so people that I knew that I was in a similar, you know, social circle with started going to prison and seeing from the inside the experience and in corresponding with people and in learning more about it and its various facets, you know, from how crazy expensive phone calls are to, you know, censorship of certain books and magazines and the tensions within prisons. So those things started becoming more present, more real to me, as they are to the millions of people who have family in jails and prisons around the country. I myself have also been in numerous jails throughout the country, so I've seen that side of the so-called criminal justice system on more than a dozen occasions. And I think that after you leave a jail cell, in my experience and what I've heard from other people, there's this kind of heavy obligation of like, just what do I do with what I just learned? You know, even if you were only in there for a day or two, the things that you saw, the people that you met, it's a pretty quick eye-opening experience at just how twisted, you know, this whole system is.
Tell us about this convergence that's happening in D.C. What are the goals and who's coming to it?
Great. June 11th through the 13th, we'll be gathering in D.C. with the convergence is specifically targeting the toxic prison scenario around this country where prisons are the cause of pollution, where people are experiencing, you know, health problems related to being in prison or near prisons. And we have several noted former prisoners who will be participating and support people or family members of prisoners that will be there. One, for example, is Eric McDavid, who is an environmental activist who was put in prison. His prison was also a military Superfund site that was known as a toxic location, and it's not uncommon that prisons are built on Superfund sites or near Superfund sites for former mines, military bases, that sort of thing. Ramona Africa from the MOVE organization in Pennsylvania will also be there, and one of the keynote speakers, and we'll be also targeting the Bureau of Prisons' proposal to build a new federal prison on top of a mountaintop removal coal mining site. And so there'll be a protest on Monday, the 13th, which will be the culmination of the convergence.
That was Panayoti Solkas, co-founder of the Prison Ecology Project. Learn more about the project and their upcoming campaign to fight toxic prisons convergence by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Citizen activist and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader's latest book is titled Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think, which is also the name given to a very special four-day event sponsored by Nader's group, the Center for the Study of Responsive Law, that will take place in Washington, D.C., May 23rd through the 26th. The event, which commemorates the 50-year anniversary of the publication of Nader's first book, Unsafe at Any Speed, is dedicated to exploring ways to mobilize the public to break through the structures of power, holding back democratic solutions to our nation's and world's many crises and conflicts. Each day of the conference, that will be held in the Capitol's historic Constitution Hall, is focused on one of four topics: how it's done, the media, war, and Congress. Speakers engaging on these topics include activists, academics, and authors from a wide variety of disciplines and political perspectives. On the final day of the conference, a new civic agenda will be unveiled to be advanced by citizens in each congressional district across the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Ralph Nader, who talks about the objectives of his Breaking Through Power conference and offers some observations on some of the major issues that have emerged in the 2016 election campaign.
The 4 days are broken down into four categories. And the theme is it's a lot easier to make change than most people think. And some people may say, oh, yeah, prove it. All right, well, day one is Breaking Through Power, How It's Done. And there are 17 groups who've been doing it on small budgets and great stamina by a few people for years. I think the total years worked by these groups is about 800 years. Don't say you can't make change in this country with a small group, especially if it reflects what Abraham Lincoln called the public sentiment, what we call today public opinion. No one in history has brought together more groups on more redirections and reforms for our country under one roof. And that wasn't that hard, because most conventions, as you know, and conferences are single issue. People have conferences on health care. They have conferences on zoning issues. They have conferences on taxes. Well, this tries to get over the silo effect and show that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
What is your hope for any concrete goal to come out of all these luminaries of activism on the whole range of issues, as you just said, breaking the silo? What would you like to see come out of this 4-day conference?
Well, one, I'd like these groups to get more visibility and support from around the country. They don't brag very much. Number two, I'd like in an election year to have this be a reassertion of the civil society, without which we don't get good politics. We get terrible politics. And if we're all going to just focus on the candidates until November and not support public movements, public demonstrations, then we're not going to be able to nourish the election campaign with all kinds of subjects and issues that are being ignored and taken off the table by both the Republican and Democratic Party. The third thing we want to accomplish is to form two groups. One, Voices, which will go and challenge the commercial media and the cable monopolies for not allowing enough serious content. Just look at Saturday morning NBC, CBS, Fox, ABC, and look at the cable stations on Saturday morning and afternoon, and you'll say, why are they using our property this way? It's We own the public airways. We're the landlord, the TV radio stations are the tenants, and nothing else going on in America. There's no labor channel, no consumer channel, no student channel. I think our expectation levels have been too low, Scott. We have to raise them, because if we don't raise the expectation levels, we don't heed what was said so many years ago by the great abolitionist when he said, power concedes nothing without a demand.
Ralph, you've long railed against the disservice of our corporate media system, especially when it comes to politics and economic issues. Maybe you could name for us what we're seeing unfolding here with especially the Trump phenomenon, where he's gotten billions of dollars of free airtime because it boosts their ratings. And it seems quite clearly profit-driven in terms of how much attention Donald Trump is getting. But how do we fix the media system so they're more driven by issues in the public interest than their short-term, next quarter profit statement?
Well, there are some easy ways. One is to intelligently demonstrate right around a TV station. Usually they have a big parking lot and they have their own building. And when they go on the evening news, 5 o'clock or whatever, they got 300-400 people outside basically saying, let us in. It's our property. You're not covering the local community. You're not covering the state. You're not adhering to the 1934 Communications Act, which requires you to recognize the public interest, necessity, and convenience. And can you imagine yourself, Scott, you're about to deliver the 5 o'clock news, and all of a sudden, 300-400 people are surrounding your two-story building. What are you going to do? Are you going to ignore it? And that's a good educational technique to show people. A lot of people don't realize that the public airways belongs to us, and we're giving it away free 24/7 to very profitable commercial radio and TV stations, unregulated by a supine Federal Communications Commission, battered by a supine Congress, greased by campaign funds from the communication, broadcast, and cable industry, and fearful of their coverage back home if they take them on.
That was citizen activist, author, and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Find more details and links to the schedule for Nader's Breaking Through Power Conference by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.